This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to this week's episode. I'm Chris Stafford and I'm going to be joined today by a retired FEI five-star judge and USCF senior dressage judge, that is Axel Steiner, who will be here to expand on the upcoming USDF Connection article about national versus international judging, and in particular, panel judging. And that will be followed by a short excerpt from the Competition Open Forum that was held during the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention, in which the subject of panel judging was discussed. And then later on, Dr. Hilary Clayton will be back with part three of the series on rider biomechanics. As always, we'd like to remind you that the views of the host and guests of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. And before we hear from Axel, we have one item of news that is returning to the FEI Nations Cup CDIO 5-star that was held in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. The Dutta Corporation's US dressage team clinched a gold medal victory over seven countries in the fourth Nations Cup in this series. The team, comprised of Laura Graves, Olivia Lagoya-Welts, Casey Perry-Glass, Dawn White O'Connor, and with the team led by chef d'équipe Robert Dover, they displayed their ability to persevere and continue to grow in their international performances. And as Robert pointed out, with just over a year to go to the World Equestrian Games, this is a year of building depth in our team by introducing many fresh new combinations mixed with our fantastic veterans. And now for our first guest this week, Axel Steiner, who is well known to many of you. He's a retired FEI 5-star and USEF senior dressage judge who has judged at Olympic Games, Pan American Games, the FEI World Cup Dressage Finals, and numerous other championships. He's also an L program faculty member and a popular commentator for high-level competitions. And he's here now to discuss the difference between national and international competitions and how panel judging affects competitors. So where would you like to start with this, Axel?
Well, I really like to start right from the bottom up and more get the idea across and the acceptance across by all concerned that really a dressage class should be judged by more than one judge. At least two, preferably three. And we would like to start that right at the schooling show level, where some of the L graduates that are hopefully eventually take their exam for little R get practice, and little R judges get practice to judge already on panels, to get that constant feedback back and forth. And that's going to be a big advantage, certainly for the rider, because the rider gets two opinions at least, but it's a tremendous learning experience for the judges, because they have to look at the same thing, and later on they'll talk about it. What did you do with such and such? What was the feedback? Oh, I gave a 9 for such. Oh, I did too. Wow, what a feedback. What a boost. Oh, yeah, good. Same thing with the low score. Oh, I had to give a 3. The other judges, yeah, I give a 3 or a 4. Tremendous feedback for the judges to make them more confident in adjudicating. And that goes all the way up from the schooling shows all the way up to Grand Prix. I mean, the fact that we have Grand Prix classes that are being judged by one judge is really unheard of. And I know we've been doing it for years and years, and I've been doing it for years and years, but I think we slowly need to get away from that for the benefit of the rider and the judges.
Now, one of the points that you make is about how dressage judges can move up this ladder from small R to large R, and to close that gap in what is already a very well-established system. So what can be done then to improve it and to get it wider across in terms of experience and everything? I mean, you mentioned the panels, Axel, but I think just for our listeners' benefit, to understand how they can move up the ladder if they're coming into judging.
Well, the main thing, if they're coming into the judging, I mean, they can move up the ladder right now with our established system. I mean, the system, as you already said, is established. But if they have panel experience, they're going to be much more experienced judges, moving up. The quality of the judging will improve instantaneously from the bottom up. And that, to me, is the important part. At the same time, they also, by having been able to judge on panels, will be able to do more shows or more classes. And the more you judge, the better you get. At the same time, you also comply with some of the number requirements that the Federation puts on, that every judge has to judge so many shows, which, by the way, is much too low, because in order to really move up, you have to have a lot of judging experience, and the only way to get experience is to do it.
Right. Well, one of the points you make is that many, both smaller and larger judges, can't get enough show appointments to fulfill their annual requirements. What are those requirements right now, and what do you think needs changing there, Axel?
Well, I think the requirements, and I don't have it right in front of me, how many shows per year you're judging, it's in the rule book. It's not all that much. But the idea is that by able to be judging in panels, you comfortably get to the required numbers, okay, if that's all you're looking for. Most people judge many, many more times the required numbers. But you're doing it in such a way that it is also not only a learning experience for the writer, but also a learning experience for the judge. Again, I'm looking for better judging and more cohesive judging, and for more confidence also in the writer, because the writer will have much more confidence if he gets two opinions that are somewhat similar on the same ride, instead of one opinion one week and a totally different opinion the following week. To jump ahead a little bit, I know my plan is a little bit looking in aghast by some show managers, because potentially it could cost a little bit more. And it's cost already an enormous amount to put shows on. And show managers, well, our show managers, we don't have shows. So I am all for protecting our show managers. But by able to double up, that little R judge can sit on the side and get his shows, get his experience in judging him with maybe a big R judge who also has a little bit limited opportunity to judge. If a show manager just needs to hire one judge, the easiest one to judge to hire is an S judge, because an S judge can judge everything. An S judge not necessarily needs all that experience.
Right, but one of the points you make there is about reducing the judging fees there. That, of course, would be a hot potato. Have you had any reaction to that idea at the moment as you're putting these ideas forward, Axel?
Oh, sure. Money is always a hot potato. But somehow, especially those of us been in the sport for a while, now, there's always a little bit of a give back, too. We have to give back to the sport. And if it would be necessary for a little R judge to get experience so they can move to big R, and for a big R judge to get more experience to move to S, it should be worth something to them. So they should be able to reduce their fees a little bit, because some of them are quite expensive. But at the same time, I'm perfectly fine as an S judge if I know that's going to be panel judging there, and I'm going to be, let's say, as a more experienced judge, be a kind of the reference judge. I'm perfectly willing to reduce my daily fee somewhat to accommodate the show manager, because in the end result, again, the show manager has to be able to do all this. But I think we all need to pitch in a little bit. It's not just one versus everybody else. We all, as a sport, have to go into it. That eventually, that if you move up, I can see already from moving up from little, let's say from big R to S, you should have panel experience. And you certainly, and I think that would be mandatory, that you have significant panel experience if you want to go from S judge to FEI judge. That is absolutely essential. You cannot enter the FEI field without having panel experience.
So how is this proposal being carried forward then, Axel? Obviously, you've written about it for the USDF Connection magazine, and we're talking about it here today. Where are you in terms of pushing this notion forward to the USEF for the national judges?
I think we're doing it right now. We talked about it last year at the USDF convention. It was brought up. Gary Rockwell certainly was very much in favor of it. We've been amongst us and the senior judges been talking about this for years. It's just now, maybe because I have a little more time and can generate a little bit of conversation on it, we need to push it a little bit. It's not going to be easy. But on the other hand, quite a few show managers, especially in some of the bigger shows, already recognize this and are already doing it. But it's just spotty. A few show managers here, a few show managers there. I just did a couple of shows just this month and last month. And we had certainly at least a half a day or so of panel judging. That was just a try-on. We did some panel judging. So it's coming. But it needs to be more uniform and at the smaller shows. So that's where some of the even score differences seem to still appear. It's not that the big shows anymore. It's the smaller shows where you have some big differences of opinion sometimes between one judge and another judge. And these big differences of opinion will go away when you start judging in panels.
And, of course, we should keep in mind that this is an advantage, too, for the competitors.
Absolutely. It's all for the competitor. It's all for the competitor, but also then all for the judges, because they are getting much, much better. That daily feedback, that conversation with other judges, that re-verification of yes, I did the same way, or what did you do here? Oh, I should think about this. Those conversations are invaluable learning experiences. People have been asking me, what do we miss most about international judging, now traveling all over the world? And some people think it's the travel. No, it's not. I miss most sitting on panels, because that was the interesting part, to constantly calibrate your standard, constantly on every horse, on every movement, calibrate, because these scores are available now. Anybody can look at it now on a computer, even movement by movement, and see what your score was vis-a-vis somebody else's score. And that's where the learning comes in. And then later on, the conversation, sometimes over a glass of wine or two in the evening, saying, hey, what do you do with such and such and such and such? That's where you learn. That's a give and take between colleagues. And it's absolutely invaluable. So panel judging, I was just talking to judging with Lilo Ford last week, and we had the same thing. Said, yeah, missing panel judging. We all love it. I was very fortunate. I've been an FEI judge for over 33 years. I was very fortunate to very early on be thrown into panels with some very strong judges. And that was a true learning experience. And it was wonderful, absolutely invaluable. And hopefully that made me a pretty decent judge.
So what would you say, finally, Axel, to the members that are listening here to push this notion forward? What can they do? How can they help to promote panel judging?
Just be positive about it. Encourage show managers. Maybe encourage it even financially. Maybe sponsor a way to allow a show manager to hire an extra judge or two. Also encourage it to GMOs and then through the GMOs, through USDF, and also then to our national federation to encourage it. Really, yeah, there's a groundswell. We really want panel judging.
Very good. Well, thank you very much indeed for sharing that with us, Axel. And as I said, you can read more about this in the USDF Connection magazine under the Judges box. Axel, very good to catch up with you. Thank you again for taking the time to come on the program.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And we're going to hear now a short excerpt from the Competition Open Forum that was held during the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention, in which panel judging was discussed.
I'm Sue McEwen. I'm the chair of the Competition Management Committee, and just want to talk about a couple of things. The first is discussion of panel judging. The judges have asked and have talked about the benefits to especially up and coming judges, to be on a panel, meaning having a smaller judge sitting on the side, more senior judge at sea, the opportunity to judge the same test, the same ride, see what the consistencies are, see what the differences are, and be able to discuss that after the class at a lunch break or in the evening. Sounds wonderful, definitely would help with education. The issue comes with competition management of the cost. There's the cost of the second judge, not just the judge's fee, but the expenses, hotel, travel, etc. Small cost of extra tests, small cost, if you continue of doing it, of incremental scoring. So you now have an extra judge that you have to have score. You might have to add another score or whatever. So a lot of discussion about what's the best way that we can do this as competition managers, still protect our bottom line, whether we're trying to do a nonprofit show or whether, you know, the profit of the show is something that's important. Definitely a loss is important, and yet help with the panel judging. A lot of discussion in terms of holding the fees, reducing fees, that the judges would be willing to take a reduced fee in order to have this opportunity. Small R and large R judges actually need to have judging opportunities as they move forward, so they may look upon this as part of their own training and be willing to say, I'll pay my expenses. I know in the New England area, we have several small R judges who are willing to pair together, and so therefore the two small R's will go to a show. The first day, Judge A will be judging and the other judge will be the scribe, and then the second day they will flip. This allows the competitors to have two different judges, okay, for their small R, and you know, the judges rooming together, et cetera, will help some with expenses. So, you know, different ideas that can be used. But definitely something, if throughout the country, we can look at what are ways that we can do this to help our judging capability. Any questions or suggestions or issues on that area?
Dave Schmutz from Region 7 in California. I'm a senior judge. And one of the things that I want to emphasize here, and this is really important, about the competitors. And there is a perception many times by the competitors that by having two judges, naturally there is going to be one score on the panel which is lower. And there has been a bit of resistance by some of the competitors in some regions about having a panel because of the fact that it's perceived that there is a lower score. And as a result of that, the composite score is going to be by nature lower. It may not. But we're basically here to administer to you. You are the consumer, you are the people who are paying for this, but I'm asking the indulgence of the competitors to allow this to go forward. Again, we want to please you, we want to give you as much input as you possibly can get. So if you can be a little patient and a little supportive, I think you're going to find this to be a very, very good procedure. It's the way that it's done in the majority of the world. In Europe, my gosh, it's very rare to have one judge doing anything. So in this country, I think it would probably be a lot better for the competitors. It's just a matter of your allowing it to occur. If you can be a little patient with us, it would greatly be appreciated.
And a reminder again that the article on panel judging, National versus International Judges, by Axel Steiner, will be featured in the next edition of the USDF Connection magazine. And the USDF would like to encourage those of you who are attending the annual convention in Kentucky later this year to attend the open meetings and forums. Along with being educational, these meetings also allow for input from attendees. And this input, of course, helps shape the future of dressage in the US. And now in our education segment, we continue the series on rider biomechanics that was recorded at the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. In part three of this series, Dr. Hilary Clayton, who is a full-time researcher, talks about the current research that's being done on the rider seat.
What does the research show us about how riders, dressage riders, normally use their pelvis as they're trotting along? So what we see is that in the mid-stance position, so as you are descending into the saddle, your pelvis is tilting a little bit forward, so your seat bones are moving out a little bit behind you. And what that movement does is that it helps to absorb the movement of the horse as the horse goes down and then starts to come up again. And then as the horse is going up into the suspension, your pelvis is rotating in the opposite direction, your seat bones are sliding forward on the saddle, and your back is getting a little bit rounder. So at the top of the suspension, your back is a little bit round. At the bottom of the stance phase, your back is a tiny little bit hollow. And that's the normal movement cycle for an experienced dressage rider. Now, if you ask that rider to actively influence the horse, to collect the horse, then the whole cycle of movement is lower. It has more backward pelvic tilt, right? So when you're actively riding the horse and trying to collect the horse, you're riding with that backward pelvic tilt and your seat bones moved more towards the front of the saddle. Can you sort of imagine that feel? So when you ride the horse in collection, the rider has that posterior backward pelvic tilt throughout the stride. And when that happens, the seat bones move forward. So the center of pressure, which represents where the rider's weight is distributed to the saddle and the horse's back, that also moves forward. So the rider's weight is acting more forward towards the horse's withers. And also, the rider's weight is being distributed over a smaller area of the horse's back. Why do I tell you this? Because, you know, I think it's possible for horses that are ridden all the time with the rider sort of asking for this high degree of collection, those horses sometimes get a sore back around the withers. So, you know, it's much better to ride in collection for a while and then have a break, have a walk break or have a break with the horse able to stretch. Let's think about alignment of the spine and the rider's body from the front, or in this case, we're looking from the back. So the picture in the middle shows the rider's head, neck, thoracic and lumbar spine and pelvis perfectly aligned vertically. And that's fine, but we can't maintain that position all the time when we're riding. The horse's back is swaying and moving from side to side, the left side up, the right side down, and that changes throughout the stride. So how should we compensate for that? Well, we should compensate as much as possible through the movements of the pelvis relative to the rest of the body. So we're trying to keep our trunk and head and neck and arms independent of those movements of the horse's back. And this is a large part of what we think about as having an independent seat. We're able to move our pelvis independently of the rest of our body. And you should be able to work on this ability to move your pelvis side to side, up and down, without moving the rest of your body. Okay? Independent pelvic movement. Now, when your riders are not straight, right, they're leaning, I think it's important for, if you're a coach, a trainer, to be able to analyze why are they leaning, right? Are they leaning their entire body with the trunk and the pelvis aligned, right? So whole body lean, or are they dissociating the movements of the trunk from the pelvis so they're actually just leaning their upper body and shoulders? Or sometimes the rider will actually shift their whole seat and body to one side of the saddle. And it's a lot more helpful if the rider can get information about, well, your seat is in the center of the saddle or not. Your pelvis is level or it's not. Your trunk is leaning or it's not. So what does the research show about all this? How do people actually sit and ride? I'm going to show you now the results of a few surveys that have been done where they've taken just a population of riders, made measurements on how they ride. This first study is one from England, and they studied a group of right-handed riders. They were all right-handed. We don't have any lefties in here. And they were riding at sitting trot. And in this group as a whole, 8 out of 10, so 80% of the riders were leaning and rotating the trunk. And the way that they leaned consistently was that the pelvis was high on the left, the trunk angle was low on the left, which is what we call collapsing the left hip. And also, both the trunk and the pelvis were twisted a little bit with the right side going back. Okay, left hip collapsed and a little bit twisted to the right. Of course, what they don't know from this study is whether left-handed riders would do the same thing, but in the opposite direction. And it's not necessary that that would be the case. The few studies that we've got that have both right-handed and left-handed riders, the difference between the two sides is not consistently sort of symmetrical. All of these are on the straight. If we look at people riding on circles left and circles right, they're not mirror images of each other, either for the riders or for the horses. Anyway, here's another study. This one was also from England. This was 17 female riders, and they don't tell us whether they're left or right-handed. But consistently, when these riders were walking, trotting, or cantering on the left lead, and they made observations both on the straight and I think on the turns as well in this one, these riders, under those conditions, had more movement of the right shoulder. The exception was in the right lead canter when both shoulders moved equally. But if you averaged it out over the entire stride, there wasn't any significant difference between them. And this study also found that the rider's right leg was longer than their left leg. And, you know, all of the studies that we have, they look at small pieces of the picture. I think what we're lacking in the research field at the moment is a much bigger, more comprehensive study of riders. So, you know, these little bits that I'm giving you are just the pieces that people have so far put into the puzzle. And they don't always fit together. That's the slightly confusing part. Usually, you only vary one thing. So you have a group of riders on the same horse, or you have one or maybe two riders. And, you know, I wasn't involved in collecting this research. Some studies are done more rigorously than others. You know, some data analysis or data collection equipment is more accurate than others. Okay, then we went to this one, showing that the right leg was longer than the left leg. The thing I wonder about here is that for this study and the next one I'm going to show you, the majority of people are right-handed and right-legged. If you're right-handed and right-legged, that is more your more dexterous, movable side. The left side is the stronger side, right? The left leg, that's my dominant leg, that's the leg I would choose to stand on and balance on. So it may be related to the side dominance in that the left side is the side that the rider has more anchored on the horse, and the right side is kind of flopping around a little bit. Except then when we canter to the right, we're more conscious of how we're using our right side to influence the canter. And this is another different study. We don't know the handedness of the riders, but 10 out of 12 showed more outward rotation of their right leg than their left leg. And again, you know, I think if we know that 80% of the population are right-legged, they have a more stable left leg, then you could imagine that they might be stabilizing themselves with the left leg, and the right leg is just kind of hanging there, wobbling around a bit. So that would be the best explanation I could come up for at the moment. There's another study where riders were asked to just sit on a flat surface, you know, a surface like this table, not a saddle, and they were asked to sit with equal weight on the left and right seat bones. What they did was that they virtually all of them had more weight on the left seat bone than the right. So these riders had rather poor perception of how their weight was being distributed. And again, it may come from that left side being, in general, the more stable side. So when you see somebody sitting on a horse and they're crooked, what do you usually assume, or what do you think of first as being the problem? It could be the rider, it could be the saddle, it could be the horse. There was a big study in England, actually done by veterinarians, but they went out and looked at a lot of big stables and looked for saddle slip. And their results showed that the most common reason for the saddle to, for the rider to sit crookedly was because the horses had a hind limb lameness, either one or both hind limbs. Now, that's not to say it can't sometimes come from the rider or it can't come from a saddle that's incorrectly stuffed, but a lot of horses are putting the riders off to the side. Because they're lame, they're going with their back down on one side more than the other, usually down on the side of the lame hind leg, but not always. So it's not even consistent which way they'll shift the saddle. So the lame horse is moving both the saddle and the rider off to the side. And if you have a horse that's lame and it's moved the saddle off, then it's almost impossible for the rider to sit straight.
And if you missed any part of this series, you can listen back to the other episodes of this podcast in which we featured parts 1 and 2. And finally, on this week's episode, we have a couple of notices for you. One is that USDF members are entitled to discounts through the USDF's Member Perks Partners. By logging into the USDF website and going to the membership tag, you can access the different discount codes and start your savings today. And the USDF Circle of Friends is essential to the mission of the US Dressage Federation, and your tax-deductible gift will have a significant impact in helping the USDF provide quality dressage education and programs. To make your contribution, we encourage you to call us at 859-971-7826. And that's it for this week's episode. As always, I remind you that you can listen to this podcast by downloading it from the iTunes podcast store, as well as online, of course, at usdf.org. To find out when the next episode is posted, be sure to follow us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. And while you're online, be sure to check eTrack at usdf.org, where you'll find loads of educational information and resources. So until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.